Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, December 3rd, 2019, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. This call's topic is a Courthouse Steps Oral Argument Teleform on Atlantic Richfield Company v. Christian. The speakers for this teleform are Mr. Jonathan Wood, who is a senior attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation, and Mr. Corbin K. Barthold, who is senior litigation counsel for the Washington Legal Foundation. Corbin will begin the discussion.
So this case basically begins back in the late 19th century when copper was discovered in Montana. The Anaconda Company quickly became one of the largest companies in the nation, and their copper mines in Montana became one of the largest copper mines in the world. For about a century, the Anaconda area was a source of, I think, something around a quarter of the world's copper. So the good news is we got a lot of copper. That means telephone wires, infrastructure, all kinds of good stuff like that. The bad news is that copper ore, when you smelt it, releases tons of pretty awful stuff, arsenic being the main one, but also lead and other bad metals. In 1977, Atlantic Richfield purchased the Anaconda Company and took over the site, and in 1980, they closed it. 1980 happens also to be the year that Congress passed the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act, which, as probably many on the call know, is a pretty quirky statute, very detailed, with a lot of sort of fascinating features that you don't see elsewhere in the law. One of those features is that liability, at least at the outset, spreads very widely anywhere that a CERCLA site has a, within the boundary of a CERCLA site. So the purpose of the law, in short, is to empower the EPA to quickly and thoroughly clean up hazardous waste sites. It is able to round up landowners in the area and basically try and coordinate a cleanup among potentially responsible parties in the area. There's really no statute of limitations, and the connection between your polluting and your responsibilities for cleanup can be kind of tenuous. And this case goes to the heart of where the boundaries are in terms of that responsibility and that timing. The Anaconda site was declared one of the first Superfund sites. It's one of the nation's largest Superfund sites. The EPA and Atlantic Richfield have spent decades working on cleaning it up. Atlantic Richfield spent somewhere around $450 million on the project. There have been many orders directing a very detailed cleanup down to how many parts per million of the soil must be arsenic to require cleanup and things like that. In, I think it was 2008, a group of landowners in Montana brought suit in Montana State Court saying, well, we don't think the EPA cleanup is adequate and challenging some of those measures. Some of the specific ones are in residential areas within the CERCLA lots of the plaintiffs. Anything over 250 million parts per million of arsenic in the soil must be cleaned out to a depth of, I've actually seen in the record, both 18 inches or 12 inches. The landowners say, well, you know, that's still a risk to health. We believe it should be 15 parts per million. Another example would be the EPA declared that the aquifer is clean under the dirt. Plaintiffs seek to have trenches built so that water can be basically filtered underground. Another thing is that pasture land, the EPA basically decided should be left alone, and the landowners say, well, no, you should clean that up as well. We don't want arsenic just sitting around in the dirt out in the pasture land. They brought claims for nuisance and trespass, other state law claims, and the fundamentals of those claims are not at issue in the case. What's really brought the dispute forth is a unique Montana remedy for restoration that allows the landowners to get not just the market value of their land as damages, but to actually get money to restore the land. And they have to show several things in order to get that money, including that they actually plan to spend that money restoring their land to basically the health it was at before the smelter put arsenic or lead on it. Atlantic Richfield in Montana State Court said, well, the other claims we don't think CERCLA necessarily has any problem with, but the restoration claim runs into several hurdles, is their case. The state court and the Montana Supreme Court disagreed with that, leading to the Supreme Court case that we just heard oral argument in. There are three arguments that Atlantic Richfield makes. The first one, which, as we'll probably get into, got almost no attention at oral argument, well, no questions at oral argument. Atlantic Richfield claims that Section 113 of CERCLA bars jurisdiction in the state court case. Section 113B says that all controversies arising under CERCLA have to go to federal court. Federal courts alone will have jurisdiction. The United States says that that alone is enough to basically strip the state court of jurisdiction here. The landowners say, well, no, all you've got to do is look at, say, 28 U.S.C. 1331, which has similar language for arising under federal question jurisdiction. And in that statute, the federal question has to actually be arising under federal law. Literally, your claim needs to be a federal law claim in almost every circumstance to create federal question jurisdiction. And this should operate the same way, that 113B should only apply in the case of a claim that actually is brought under CERCLA. The Atlantic Richfield also points to Section 113H, which says, well, okay, federal courts will have jurisdiction, but even federal courts will not have jurisdiction to a challenge to a CERCLA remedial action. So a challenge must be a subset of claims that are, you know, arising under. So if H is an exception to B, then B must encompass challenges to CERCLA remedial action. The landowners point out it's kind of odd because Section 113H says federal courts cannot hear challenges to CERCLA remedial action, but they can hear cases under diversity jurisdiction. So the explanation kind of gets shaky. Well, why would federal courts not be able to hear challenges, but can hear claims under state law diversity jurisdiction? And if those aren't challenges, or sorry, if those are challenges that are allowed, then it kind of weakens the notion that federal courts have to be the only ones that are hearing these claims. That's the first argument. The second argument, Atlantic Richfield claims that under Section 122E6 of CERCLA, a potentially responsible party must get EPA's permission to take any remedial action on a Superfund site. The definition of a potentially responsible party is not defined in the statute. And we'll get into this more, I'm sure, because it was a big deal at oral argument. But another section of the statute defines a covered person as pretty much anybody, this is only slightly overstating it, anybody who owns land on a Superfund site. And it doesn't matter if you were the polluter necessarily or not. There are defenses and exceptions, but CERCLA starts off sweeping broadly and then narrows, which actually is the core of the landowner's response. They say, well, potentially responsible party, keyword there is potentially. You may start off as a potentially responsible party and a covered person. But if, say, the statute of limitations runs and or you have solid defenses, you're no longer a potentially responsible party. You're just an innocent landowner minding your own business on a CERCLA site. So why should Section 122E6 apply to you? They also point out that Section 122E6 is in a section of CERCLA that deals with settlements. So their argument goes, the whole point is to make sure that EPA has extensive control over the site at the outset so it can round up the people that it wants to partake in the settlement and contribute to the cleanup. And once that's been sorted out, a section like 122E6 can kind of fade away. The third argument is preemption. And Atlantic Richfield raises both impossibility and conflict preemption arguments. The impossibility preemption argument can pretty simply be stated as, we would have to do a different restoration plan, and that goes against the plan that we're ordered to do by the EPA, and so there's impossibility preemption, to which the landowners respond, well, no, you're not doing the alternative cleanup. You're paying us money to take alternative measures. The conflict preemption argument is a little more nuanced. It's saying, well, CERCLA is a very complicated statute with a lot of provisions, among them being that the EPA has to clean up a site in accord with a national contingency plan, which has just an amazing number of different provisions that EPA has to satisfy in order to do a proper cleanup, including getting input from landowners, getting input from the pertinent state, making sure they meet criteria to protect health and whatnot. And this is more of a claim that in addition to our previous arguments under Section 113 and 122, because letting the landowners do their own cleanup would violate the national contingency plan in various ways. There's conflict preemption. The landowners respond, among other things, but they point to savings clauses in CERCLA. They're quite broadly stated savings clauses, and they claim, well, these clearly give us the breathing room to undertake our own remedial actions. I'll also mention this is a fascinating case in that both sides' first arguments in their briefs received no questions during oral argument. I already mentioned the Section 113 argument that got no attention. The landowners claim the court does not have jurisdiction because this is only dealing with the restoration issue and not the nuisance or trespass or other claims. The response to that is, well, Montana decided this on a supervisory writ, which Montana treats as an original proceeding, and therefore the court should as well. And that's all I've got by way of introduction.
Thank you for that introduction. I think you've covered all the areas well. The only thing I'll add, just to set up the stage for the discussion of the actual argument, is on the property owner's jurisdictional claim, I think, explains why the case is so complicated in the argument. The fact that there is not currently a remediation plan makes the case even more hypothetical than it otherwise might be. And as we'll get into when we get into the weeds of the oral argument, a lot of it was about what's really at stake here and then what are all of the possible hypotheticals that could potentially be at stake. And if this case were being reviewed at a later time where there was actually a remedy to be reviewed, I think maybe some of those might have been simplified.
So I think one way to just start going through it is to discuss where the justices seem to be and what questions seemed pertinent. Normally, I am trying to divide questions that I see in oral argument between questions that aren't necessarily what a justice is truly thinking, but are kind of probing weaknesses in their own position or exploring, and then the questions that, you know, here's what I really think about this. And I have to say, there were a lot fewer questions at this oral argument than others I've seen that I looked and thought, oh, well, that's what that justice really thinks. I think there was a lot of probing by pretty much all of the justices who spoke. One place I would start with is Justice Sotomayor, who at the outset of Atlantic Richfield's argument asked Lisa Blatt some questions that made it look like Sotomayor has a lot of concerns about conflict preemption here, and then proceeded when Joseph Palmore got up to make it sound like there's clearly conflict preemption here. And, you know, she was holding her cards kind of close to the vest. And the trend that I saw in that, if I had to sort of sum up the argument in a nutshell, I got the sense that the justices on the whole really didn't like Atlantic Richfield's statutory interpretation of 122E6. And maybe some of the consequences of it, but also really didn't like the potential consequences of giving the landowners everything they want in this case.
I think that's right. There were a couple of questions asked by the justices, including Sotomayor, that seemed to suggest they really liked the policy consequences of Atlantic Richfield's statutory argument on 122, but weren't quite sure the statute got them all the way. So several of the questions were actually framed to the property owner's attorney as, well, what's wrong with that as a policy matter? Like, why isn't it a good thing for anyone who wants to do remediation work to first go to EPA and ask for permission? Which is a separate question from what the statute says. And when the response was, well, that's not what the statute says in our view, that the justices didn't seem to be satisfied by that. They actually wanted to talk about the underlying policy merits.
Yeah, in fact, Justice Kagan was explicit about that. Mm-hmm. You know, at one point she said, well, as a policy, I'm all in favor of the EPA directing this. Mm-hmm. But... and her big but was, when I read 122E6, I don't see it doing what you, Atlantic Richfield, want it to do. She definitely seemed to take very seriously the landowner's argument that, well, why would this provision about, you know, be in a section on settlement if what it's meant to do is basically lock in these remediations forever? Mm-hmm. You know, if you want to tell landowners that they cannot pursue their own plan pretty much indefinitely because they have to leave, you know, the arsenic in the soil, they can't dig out things to a deeper level and whatnot, why would you kind of hide that in, I mean, you even just say section 122E6, right? Mm-hmm. You know, kind of hidden in there. Lisa Blatt for Atlantic Richfield's response was, well, there are elephants everywhere in CERCLA, and I thought she did amazingly well in other things that maybe we'll get into, but I wasn't convinced that by that response.
Yeah, I mean, that might be true, but when you're asking a court to find preemption where it's not necessarily clear on the face of the statute, saying, well, this statute, you know, got a ton of elements in it, really complicated, it didn't seem to me that that satisfied the justice.
What ended up happening, I felt, as the argument went on, and it was pretty clear that, well, first of all, 113 never even came up. There was never really an opportunity to say, well, if you don't like what I'm selling here, here's this other thing. So it's fascinating. We don't know what will happen with that. But they weren't satisfied with the explanation about 122E. And I had thought, I mentioned this to you beforehand, that, well, if the justices don't like the 113 argument, and if they don't like the 122 argument, I'm kind of skeptical that they're going to say, well, conflict preemption anyway, because just, you know, everybody knows CERCLA is meant to be covering this situation. And yet they kind of drifted toward that. Some of them later in the argument, I felt Sotomayor asked and basically just said, shouldn't there be conflict preemption? Justice Ginsburg asked a question along those lines. Justice Alito asked a question along those lines. And Justice Kavanaugh made, you know, the point, well, it's the comprehensive environmental law. So, you know, shouldn't we take the very name of it seriously? And you can go, you can have different feelings about that, but that's the direction I felt the argument kind of moved.
Yeah, but at the same time, the justices also asked enough questions cutting the other way that it seems to me there's still a lot of uncertainty. So you mentioned Sotomayor's first question was, well, what in the statute suggests that Congress was setting a federal ceiling? The way it's actually framed, it seems like a federal floor, and then you have these savings clauses that expressly say states can regulate above it. And it seemed to me that she didn't get a very good answer to that on just the general conflict preemption argument. There's the 122 may be the answer there, but as a standalone preemption argument, it seemed to me that that's a big challenge, that the way the statute's written, it's not clear why or that Congress wished to basically cap remediation at whatever EPA says.
Yes, and what ended up being sort of a stopgap solution that I feel people came in, and Sotomayor brought this out right at the outset, but it seemed to be where several justices were heading, was, well, why don't we basically rule for the landowners with the exception, and it's the exception that kind of swallows everything the landowners of, but say the landowners have to prove in court that the EPA will approve their alternative plans. And a satellite conversation around this was, well, are we now just arguing about who has the burden? Is it up to the EPA at the outset to make it clear that it thinks parties are potentially responsible parties, so that it protects itself against the statute of limitations? Or is it up to the landowner sort of at the outset to make clear that they want a different plan and get the EPA's approval before they take any further steps? And I felt that that dispute was left kind of in the air.
Yeah, Kavanaugh and, if I recall correctly, Kagan expressed some concern of how, given these sites are huge and there are over 1,300 of them, how is EPA ever supposed to know what every individual landowner is doing? So if you put the onus on EPA to use other tools other than preemption to try to supervise these remedial efforts, how is that supposed to work? So in this particular Superfund site, it's 300 square miles with a ton of property owners using their properties in very different ways. So if EPA is supposed to know instantly what those landowners are up to and what actions might have environmental consequences, that would be very difficult to administer.
Yeah, so that was definitely a concern. A related concern that I thought Chief Justice Roberts, kind of a slight, sort of a partner to that concern that he raised, is it's not just these landowners. So one topic that also kind of didn't really get resolved is, do the landowners' plans, are they more or are they different? You know, and Lisa Black kind of put in those terms that at one point, more is not necessarily better with environmental cleanup. So the EPA says, well, we tell you that you need to dig out your dirt to 12 inches. Then we cap it. We put some fresh vegetation over that to keep any arsenic that's even deeper down protected. If you then proceed to dig up 18 inches or more, you're potentially aerating that arsenic. And that's actually a worse outcome than just having one plan and EPA doing one coordinated effort. Joe Palmore said, well, actually, you know, EPA just kind of came up with these concerns out of thin air and they're not in the record. And Chief Justice Roberts didn't seem satisfied with that. He said, well, you know, maybe so for this case. What about other cases? So once again, you have a justice who sort of is really tapping into the well. I believe in the notion that the purpose of CERCLA is to have a coordinated cleanup with one overseer that has the broadest vision of the landscape and is basically calling the shots and making sure that people don't go their own way, maybe even to the point of one landowner doing something that another landowner doesn't want or puts another landowner in danger. With, again, the okay, but where do we implement that? Where do we see that in the statute? How do we get there? Do we, you know, are we allowed to get there? Is that simply not what the statute says, as Kagan sometimes suggested? Again, going to my point of real dissatisfaction with both the potential results and the statutory text in front of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and on that point, I think the position taken by the United States only further complicated because I don't know if you got this sense, but both in the oral argument and reading the transcript, my sense was the United States was careful not to say, or was careful to not say that this cleanup would necessarily be bad for the environment, or that they wouldn't actually approve this cleanup. And it might have, the case might have been simpler if they just said, oh no, absolutely not. What these guys have in mind is bad for the environment, we would definitely reject it. Then I think the justice might have had a clear way through. But the fact that the United States wasn't willing to commit on that and left it completely open, I think makes that judgment hard. Because, and this is something the property owner's attorney referenced, is that under CERCLA, EPA is not only considering environmental impacts, they're balancing those impacts against the cost of remediation. And CERCLA might, you know, weigh that balance one way, and state law might weigh it differently. And what do you do with the cleanups that might cost more, but also get you more environmental benefits? All the questions seem to assume that if there's a conflict, it's only where a remediation might actually have some environmental downside.
Mm-hmm.
The justice didn't seem to be that concerned with the idea that, well, this is inconsistent in the sense that it costs more in exchange for more environmental benefits.
Although she didn't put it in those terms, I think Justice Sotomayor was thinking in that way with her questions about, well, it's a floor, but is it a ceiling?
Mm-hmm.
And Justice Gorsuch explicitly mentioned the concern, what do we do with the EPA's sort of inconsistent statement? So I think you're right that if the EPA had just taken a firm stand from the outset, it might be a very different case. And I would imagine there are probably inside baseball reasons for that. If you're the attorney for the United States, it's probably actually very hard to get an agency to, at the outset, give that kind of answer.
Especially at this stage of the case, where you don't even really know what the remedial plan necessarily would be.
Well, Chief Justice Roberts kind of tapped into that in defense of the government, saying, well, the government is allowed to, it's a big plan, it's complicated, they can take steps, and they should be allowed, Chief Justice Roberts kind of argued, to do step A, B, C, and not have people coming in and suing about D if they haven't come in and figured out what they want to do yet. I have sympathies kind of in both directions. I mean, it's a complicated cleanup plan. On the other hand, certainly in this case, if the EPA doesn't have a firm position on these things by now.
Yeah, that's right. And for background, the EPA estimates that this remediation will be wrapped up in 2025 is their current estimate?
They said 2025, which I could be wrong. I think they like tacked three extra years.
I know.
On.
I thought it was earlier than that. But yeah, so this cleanup has been in the works for, you know, since 1983. So they're well into the planning. They should be at the end of the actual work. And I think the property owner mentioned they've done all the work they're going to do on the properties at issue in this case. So the idea that, oh, you just have to wait, EPA is going to get to that, doesn't really fit the facts of this case. The next thing I wanted to talk about is, I agree with you that it seemed like the overall momentum in the oral argument was towards this idea of you either have to prove you would get EPA approval to bring this kind of state claim, or there has to be some process by which EPA approves any work that would happen as a result of the state claim. The question that seems up in my mind, and that this didn't come up in oral argument, is what standard EPA would use in deciding whether to allow that remediation to go forward? Because under CERCLA, as I mentioned, they have to balance cost versus environmental benefits, but state law doesn't require that same balance. Assuming the justices don't do the Section 122 argument, they just create this amorphous idea of EPA has to supervise and approve a state remediation plan, what standard would EPA use?
It's actually a really good question, and I'm surprised it didn't come up at oral argument, because the answer may well be that EPA needs to come up with a plan that meets the national contingency plan, which is what they already have.
Mm-hmm.
And that because they have met that and satisfied it, they are now free to basically decide on whatever standard they feel like. If they think your backyard pool is a bad idea, they can block it. If they think your extra digging is a good idea, they can grant it.
Mm-hmm.
That seems like a weird outcome, and certainly like something you'd hope your reticulated statute would have accounted for at
mm-hmm.
some point, if that was the true rule envisioned.
Yeah, there could be maybe the out, and there was one question that I wasn't sure was trying to get at this. I can't remember. I think it may have been the Chief Justice who asked it, but or maybe it was Kagan. But maybe the idea is that EPA's approval authority at that point is just limited to, would this actually interfere with what we're doing? Like, will it undo, cause environmental consequences we were avoiding, or, you know, make what we've done less effective, as opposed to EPA saying, no, we think the requirements under state law are too expensive for the polluters, so we're just not going to allow it.
Yeah, forcing them to make that distinction would be good. That's still basically writing into the statute, though.
Yes, absolutely.
To comply with the National Contingency Plan, you don't have to worry about, well, if it's more expensive, you know, what am I trying to say? That it's more, if you've already decided that what you've done meets the health standards in compliance with the plan, then there's kind of no distinction between it disrupts our plan and it doesn't. If something is better but disrupts, you know, they still have wide-ranging discretion and can kind of do what they want.
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends a lot on what disrupts or conflicts with means, and that was definitely a point at which there was very little clarity in the oral argument. Because I think Lisa Blatt's argument was essentially that, you know, whatever EPA decides, that's it, and any departure in either direction from that is going to interfere with or undo what EPA is doing. But I could see a narrow argument or a narrow rule that simply says that EPA's analysis after any work under the National Contingency Plan is over is just limited to environmental impacts. Will this make things worse, or will this make their efforts less effective, as opposed to considering technological capabilities or costs or some of the other factors that they have to consider? Because the first is less intrusion on state authority and private property rights than the second. Because at one point the Chief Justice even asked, look, you know, the work you want to do on your property doesn't stop at the boundaries of your property. It's going to have effects on your neighbors. And that, to me, sounds like a nuisance-type tort problem. But that wouldn't extend to the cost concern.
Yeah, well, it's certainly true that it's possible that the statute mm-hmm. allows landowners to do things. And in the event, I'm sure the landowners would dispute that this is what their work would do, but let's say their work aerates arsenic, then mm-hmm. the other landowners, they're property owners, they have their rights, they can bring their lawsuit against the first landowners. So it's not automatic that CERCLA would preclude that, mm-hmm. although it would be an odd outcome. To try and come back at another angle, I think what we're coming to is that if all EPA has to do is comply with the National Contingency Plan, then they would have full freedom to deny any request to do something that is more expensive and better but different,
mm-hmm.
which, going back, that too is a weird outcome. We want to make it even better than your plan. Why can't we do that?
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, Justice Breyer certainly seemed comfortable with that outcome. You know, one of his comments was, look, we have the citizen suit provision in CERCLA. Once everything is done, you are free to go into court and use that, which would be entirely unsatisfactory to the landowners, because basically what the citizen suit provision says is you can go in and use the Administrative Procedure Act to say that what the EPA did here was arbitrary and capricious. The only thing you can really complain about is that they failed to comply with the National Contingency Plan, which goes back once again to, you may have something better, but if you can't show it violated the plan, too bad.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're limited to the administrative record that the EPA has compiled. Granted, you would have had an opportunity, I suppose, to submit to it, as landowners do earlier, but that's still, you know, you're bringing in no new evidence. You know, at one point, Justice Breyer almost kind of blithely said, well, what's wrong with that? Go,
yep.
go use mm-hmm. citizen supervision.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's definitely, Breyer to me seemed most inclined to rule in Atlantic Richfield's favor, either on the preemption or the 122 argument. To me, his questions weren't quite clear which way his thinking was going, but he definitely seemed okay with the idea that, I mean, I think at one point he even half joked about the idea that this is in effect imposing an easement on every property contained within every Superfund site in the country, limiting what property owners can do with their own money. And that's one of the other ironies in this case, is that if the 122 argument is accepted, that's not just about holding the polluter liable. If that argument's right, even a property owner who wanted with their own money to do work to improve the health of their property would have to get EPA approval. And the property owner's attorney argued that in practice, and possibly in this very case, that restriction would apply forever.
The landowner who wants to use his or her own money, it goes even further than that. Even in a situation where there's no sort of you'll make it worse kind of argument, mm-hmm. still need approval. That doesn't necessarily mean that all is lost on the Atlantic Richfield side, because I think the fundamental tension that the justices were grappling with, and there aren't necessarily clear answers, is two things can be absolutely true at once. As Lisa Blatt pointed out, arsenic never the reason the rule lasts so long is because arsenic lasts long.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a cleanup that you're packing away the toxins, if the toxins don't go away, then neither should the remediation plan. And there's a sense to that of if you're doing a cleanup plan and you need it to work and part of that involves stowing away toxic goods, then there's no reason to believe that doing something 30 years to undo that is somehow okay just because of passage of time. And then that flies completely in the face of, you know, PLF talks about in their brief and Justice Gorsuch touched on, and Justice Kagan touched on,
mm-hmm.
This notion of, well, forever. You know, that's a long time. That's an awfully mm-hmm. long time. Time is a long thing, as Churchill said. And that doesn't square with, you know, really even basic notions of how property law works in any other context.
Mm-hmm.
And should CERCLA really be special?
And there did also seem to be a suggestion from several of the justices, with the exclusion of Justice Breyer, who I think mocked this idea a little bit, that CERCLA affects a lot of activities you might not think of. That remedial action is defined so broadly that maybe it's not so broad that if you want to create a garden, you're going to have to get EPA approval. But a lot of other earth-moving activity that disturbs any sort of polluted area could require EPA approval, and that significantly intrudes on private property rights.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, in this case, so 12 inches of
mm-hmm.
topsoil.
Mm-hmm. If you want to dig below that.
Your
yeah.
kid playing in the yard could do a lot of, you know, make a lot of headway towards that limit.
Mm-hmm.
So it is interesting. There seems to be debate over how much are you allowed to do, and, oh, well, you can plant a garden and you can do this and that and the other, but you just can't upset the remediation. I'm not sure what, you know, planting a garden may well involve digging a foot of soil.
Mm-hmm.
So.
We actually do have one question.
Hi, this is Roger Candelaria. Thank you for a very interesting discussion on a topic about which I know very little. But if you were, I'm going to pose it this way, if you were a small government, free enterprise, constitutionalist, conservative, and the justice who had been assigned to write the opinion calls you and says, how should I hold on this thing? What would be the best outcome given the complicated posture that the case is in?
I think one of the funny things about that question is you have attorneys from two small government-inclined nonprofits who took opposite positions in the case. So I guess we'll start, Corbin, you know, from your perspective, why is a win for Atlantic Richfield the best outcome here?
So one data point that is in the record, and I'm not claiming that it's necessarily correct or fully accurate, but it does give a good flavor. It's been claimed that to restore these properties would cost about 7 times as much as the market value of the property. Because mind you, we're not talking about, okay, your property's been damaged, and like in most other tort suits, what you're entitled to is the market value of your land so that you're made whole. You know, in almost every other context of law, you are made whole if you get the market value. Here we're doing something that, from certainly Atlantic Richfield and perhaps a larger economy's perspective, is very inefficient. If you spend 7 times the market value of the land to restore land, could make a pretty solid argument that it's not Pareto optimal. Now, I'm not claiming there are not arguments on the other side. I mean, there's been the claim of somebody made the comment about, well, my children's heights that I've penciled in on the door are not in any other house. That kind of argument is not normally something we worry about in common law tort claims. It's more about making sure that things operate efficiently and that we don't engage in large amounts of waste. So that would be kind of the economic argument for why, if you're going to have CERCLA, you might as well try and make sure that you have a single plan that is being operated efficiently. And so it is a good, I suppose I've drifted from your constitutional to more of a law and economics analysis. But perhaps that's because if we try to do sort of a small government constitutional thing, we end up sort of begging the question. We end up arguing, well, what does CERCLA say? Because I would say a big part of that kind of attitude is rule of law. Tell me what the law, tell me what the statute says. I want to apply it, and I want to apply it as it is written. And we, you know, as we saw at the oral argument, that's a tricky question. I'm not sure there's a lot of agreement. So the last thing I'll say, and I'll hand it over to Jonathan. I mean, one quick and dirty heuristic, if you're interested in who's filed where in this case, you know, the Chamber of Commerce and the Washington Legal Foundation are on one end, but they're aligned with the Environmental Protection Agency. On the other hand, you've got Pacific Legal Foundation fighting for property rights. They're aligned with a public citizen and with a group of states, all of which are either Democrat-controlled or one of them, Mississippi, has a Democrat attorney general. And I would argue strenuously those alignments don't really tell you much. It's an interesting case in that regard. The major environmental groups have not come in. It's an interesting case that kind of cuts through those lines and asks, well, what do you do with this statute that has its defects and its problems, and which of its defects kind of speak to you when you look at it?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think the complication of the statute and some of the arguments explains the lineup and makes it difficult to have a clear answer to the question. But to give my perspective, I filed an amicus brief on behalf of Pacific Legal Foundation and the Property Environment Research Center and environmental group based out of Bozeman, Montana. And our approach was to argue constitutional avoidance, that the rights the property owners are invoking are constitutionally protected property rights. If Congress wants to take those away, courts should expect Congress to speak clearly. And without a clear statement in the statute to provide for that effect, the presumption should be that the rights haven't been preempted. So that was the approach we took. I certainly take your concern that, because the reason why they're seeking these remedies are because they're going to be a lot more than the property's worth, and that does sound inefficient. The policy argument we make in our brief is that may be okay if you take the longer view. That the reason why these remedies exist, and they exist in quite a few states for torts and for property rights violations, is that it creates the right incentives at the front end. If I'm someone who's thinking about polluting, and I know that I can pollute your property without your permission, and all I'll have to pay is the effect change in the market value, then I, as the polluter, essentially have a private equivalent to the eminent domain power. But if I know that the state courts might make me restore the property, then I have much stronger incentives to go to you at the front end and say, hey, look, my activity is going to involve pollution. What can I pay you to have the right to pollute and to resolve this amicably through the market? I think that's more likely to happen with these sorts of claims, and so that's one of the policy reasons why our brief supported the property owner. But I absolutely agree that the statute is so vague and the questions are so complex that it is very easy to wind up on either side of this case.
Well, and two follow-ons to that, one with it and one against it. I mean, one of the weird things about CERCLA is it takes pollution from, you know, the pollution here started in the 1890s, and you get these wacky results under CERCLA where, I'm not absolving Atlantic Richfield here, they bought with their eyes open, but there are other situations with CERCLA where, oh my God, you just kind of wake up one morning and you realize there's this chemical on your land and it really wasn't your fault and you're paying through the nose. So on the one hand, well, you're not going to be able to negotiate in that situation. On the other hand, I love that argument because it is a real-life application of the Coase theorem.
Mm-hmm.
When it is forward-looking, it is a literal application of it. So you have a low transaction cost situation in which two people, it doesn't even matter who starts with the property rights. You'll go out and you'll negotiate. You'll reach a voluntary agreement. The government never needs to get involved. You know, it's beautiful.
One of the issues that I was surprised, not that it came up, but the way that it came up, you mentioned Gorsuch. So I think Sotomayor and Kagan all raised the prospect of, well, these are property rights at stake. They didn't seem to raise that in support of an avoidance type argument, like the one I was describing. Mm-hmm. We made. Instead, they were just seeming to be asking, well, is there perhaps a takings claim here, and if so, who's it against, and when does it arise?
Mm-hmm.
And that surprised me. What do you think about that?
You know, as between the two of us, you're probably the takings expert. So here's my reading on it. You can tell me what's wrong. Gorsuch brought up the takings claim. I'm glad he did. Start with Lisa Blatt for Atlantic Richfield. She has no reason to really have any argument
mm-hmm.
with that. She doesn't represent the government. So
mm-hmm.
if she gets her company out of greater liability and then landowners bring taking claims, Godspeed. And that's
mm-hmm.
that's basically, she politely basically said that.
Yep.
And so the real question is the government, and they got asked the same question, and their attitude was roughly, well, look, in this kind of situation, what you'd be looking at is a diminution of the value of the land.
Mm-hmm.
I have to assume that they're thinking from market value. And there was a suggestion about, like, with the arsenic. I don't think that's right. It's market value without arsenic on your land. But I think they're probably thinking market value and not restoration value, and it just doesn't worry them much, was my read on it.
Yes. I'm glad you brought that up, because I thought the United States answer there was unclear. And Gorsuch asked a few follow-ups, because they initially, their response was, well, look, there's no takings claim because we've increased the value of the property by doing this cleanup work. They wanted the baseline to be the heavily polluted version of the property, and in which case CERCLA improved the value. And Gorsuch pushed back and said, well, no, why wouldn't the value be with all of the property rights state law recognizes, including restoration? And that's what you've taken away. If that's right, and it's pursued as a takings claim as opposed to an avoidance claim, I think you're right that the figuring out what the proper means of compensation for that is really complicated.
I think what might happen... Well, rather than staking my own opinion, I'll say,
mm-hmm.
this is my guess of what the government was thinking.
Mm-hmm.
They're thinking, look, the what's happened here, the taking, is not the pollution from day one, because Anaconda is not the government. But what
mm-hmm.
has happened is, with CERCLA requiring a cleanup, the government has then stepped in and frozen it in place and said,
mm-hmm.
you can't change it. And so the taking is, you know, everything under the 12 inches of soil, or the soil that can't have the trench in it, or you know, basically just these things around the edges, and then they see that it's just the diminution of value that you can't dig deeper.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably their attitude. I mean, I looked into this, and it's absolutely clear that CERCLA, the CERCLA cleanup ends, you go into the federal claims court, you make your taking claim, and that's happened. I mean,
mm-hmm.
there's been cases where you have to have a well built on your land, and you go in, and the government owes you for that well. So maybe their attitude is just, well, it's going to be diminution of the value. It's not much. We're not fazed by that.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's your attitude, there's really maybe no need for avoidance as their attitude.
Mm-hmm.
Another angle, and there's an 11th Circuit opinion that has this issue, but it all goes to 113, which was never discussed at oral argument, is, well, you want your clear statement. You know, here's your clear statement. Federal court cannot hear a challenge to a CERCLA remedial action. Now, you still have that weird diversity jurisdiction thing I mentioned
mm-hmm.
way at the outset for anybody who's been listening closely. And, of course, you have the fact that the landowners don't think that applies in this case. But were it to apply, actually, Judge Carnes in the 11th Circuit, who's no fool, you know, said, look, Congress is allowed to strip even constitutional claims temporarily and say, look, you have to wait.
Mm-hmm.
Because this cleanup needs to get done, and once the cleanup's done, then you can go to the federal claims court and do your thing, and there's nothing suspect about that.
Yeah, and that is absolutely the argument Lisa Blatt argued in her reply, which I thought was a little dismissive about what kind of consequences that could mean for the federal government, because one of the reasons for that courts have in the past required a clear statement before interpreting a statute to take private property is courts might accidentally impose a lot of liability on the federal government that Congress never intended or allowed. And the temporary takings or the effect of the pollution below 12 inches could significantly affect the value of properties multiplied over the hundreds of square miles on one site times the 1,300 total sites. I mean, if you're talking about someone's home, the home probably loses a lot of value if the buyers all know that, oh yeah, there's arsenic 12 inches down. Be careful when you dig. We were talking before that we're both recent dads, and I don't know about you, but I probably wouldn't buy that house.
Yeah,
knowing
sure.
that's there. No matter what the discount is, I'm not buying that
mm-hmm.
house. And so that seems to be part of the concern of the landowners, and they emphasize this in their briefs and in some of the media they've got about it. Is, look, these are our homes and our community. It's not a pollution of some commercial site where maybe some of these concerns aren't the same. Well, I'm glad that Justice Gorsuch...
Gentlemen, I just want to hop in real quick. We have another question, actually, that's popped up. I want to make sure we have time to get to that person.
Hi, this is Larry Schnaff. I'm a CERCLA practitioner and also an environmental law professor. I came in late to your conversation, so I apologize if these questions I have you've already covered. But my understanding, this was originally a 113H question as to whether, in terms of the pre-enforcement bar, which I think you guys just mentioned is only a temporary bar. And then, you know, we have a lot of risk-based cleanups under CERCLA where contaminated soil is allowed to be removed. And the way they've been typically enforcing this is through deed restrictions and institutional controls. And if the adjoining property owner doesn't comply, they're deemed to have lost, you know, they could be potentially a responsible party because they haven't exercised appropriate care. And the other thing is, you know, we're developing a lot of sites across the country where contamination is at depth and you do have, say, 12 inches or 24 inches of protective soil or a cap. So and the last thing is that, you know, the case law is pretty clear in the CERCLA that CERCLA doesn't preempt common law claims if there's no double recovery. So, you know, like, for example, here in New York, if you have a, you can bring nuisance actions and they're not preempted by CERCLA provided there's not double recovery. And since CERCLA is limited to cost recovery, I'm not sure why, what the question is about property damage claims. They should be able to continue forward.
That last point did come up in oral argument. The property owner's attorney cited the prohibitions on double recovery in support of the argument that here that's not a concern. The recovery would be for additional work beyond that ordered by EPA. Of course, the United States, neither the United States nor ARCO are claiming that the property owners are resulting in double recovery, so it's really a side issue. As we said at the outset, the jurisdictional argument was raised by ARCO early in the argument, but it got no questions, so my sense is it doesn't have a lot of supporters on the.
It's an interesting question.
Yes.
There's a certain amount of path dependence with these
yes.
oral arguments.
Mm-hmm.
And so you never know. It could be in someone's mind. It could pop up in the opinion. But it didn't get a single question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Similarly, it's possible that the property owner's jurisdictional argument will have purchase. I don't know how you feel about this, but my sense of the oral argument in thinking about it before the oral argument was this case has significant potential for a weird split of, you know, not a 5-4 split, but a 2-2-2-2-1 split. And if the court's unable to reach a majority, does that affect their thinking? Maybe these jurisdictional questions get a bit more attention because maybe they're easier.
That could be. I, for one, am satisfied that if Montana wants to say a supervisory writ is an original controversy, that goes and the you know, so then the landowner's jurisdictional issue goes away. But
mm-hmm.
nobody's asking me to write on it, so we'll see.
And yeah, and I think the court could go that direction without saying that we could never review an issue like that. They might simply dig it and say, we'll look at it when we have an actual remedy.
It would be pretty rough on kind of all the parties and everybody if 113 becomes a big deal in the opinion, if only because it's really complicated. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's not an easy issue. You have a rule that says arising under CERCLA equals federal courts.
Mm-hmm.
And you have arguments about what that means. And then you have an exception to that rule that says challenges to remedial actions. Oh, except if there's diversity jurisdiction. And how does that inform the rule? Does it inform the rule? What does challenge even mean? The landowners don't go quietly into the night that means. The kind of remedies that they're looking for here.
Mm-hmm.
There are just worlds within that dispute all by itself in this case. And so for that to be dispositive with no discussion at oral argument would be very striking.
Mm-hmm. And it's another example where the complexity of the statute probably makes that argument more difficult too. Because if you look at the challenge language in isolation, I think ARCO's argument's pretty strong. But then when you look at it in the context of a broader provision saying federal courts get to review claims under CERCLA, then it doesn't necessarily seem as broad. So it goes back to Kagan's questions about 122 being in the settlement provision. To what extent does the context of where these provisions are located affect how they're interpreted?
Absolutely. And I think we can all agree on Thurgood Marshall's comment that CERCLA is not a model of legislative draftsmanship.
Mm-hmm. Is there an argument for making the ruling as just chaotic as possible to force Congress to come back to the drawing board?
I don't, you know, it would be very unfortunate if you have a decision, you know, everybody comes to the court and says, please clarify the meaning of the statute, and they end up having a fractured opinion that just causes more confusion.
Yep.
Would be too bad. My guess, and this is kind of getting into the broader world, I mean, the Superfund is chronically underfunded.
Mm-hmm.
And people on all sides have complaints about it. Although you could argue that the fact that everybody complains about it shows it's kind of doing its job, maybe, that like nobody's satisfied,
mm-hmm.
maybe. But you could also argue that it needs a fresh look. So that's an interesting question. I haven't really thought about it. I certainly wouldn't want them to do it as a deliberate tactic. But
mm-hmm.
it would be very interesting if they sort of reached a decision that was so fractured that it caught eyes across the street at
mm-hmm.
the Capitol.
Yeah, on that point, one of the interesting things is it didn't come up in oral argument, but because Superfund has been so chronically underfunded, there are groups that would like to engage in private voluntary cleanups, Good Samaritans, and there's a defense in the statute to protect them, but it's got some concerns and hasn't necessarily worked the way Congress intended. And I think one of the things that perhaps the court should have been reminded of or had in their mind is that if they go down this route of EPA approval is always necessary for everything, that's going to affect not only the ordinary landowner who you might be concerned will do something they shouldn't or get in over their head, but also sophisticated environmental groups that are buying these lands for the express purpose of cleaning them up. And if you wall them out, you've lost a potential source of revenue that could fill the gap left by underfunded CERCLA.
It's an interesting point.
Yeah.
I'd like to thank our speakers today on behalf of the Federalist Society and also our audience for joining us. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org, and thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.